Cambridge, Massachusetts. WHDH News and Public Affairs present the Harvard Law School Forum. Tonight, recorded highlights of the address last Friday night of Edward Bennett Williams. Now, to introduce Mr. Williams, here is moderator Paul M. Batter, professor of law, Harvard.
On behalf of all of you, I can say that it's a very great pleasure to welcome Edward Bennett Williams back to Cambridge. He last addressed this forum, I'm told, in 1960. Since 1960, as we all know, the Williams saga has gone from one excitement to the next, as in the perils of Pauline, each challenge outdoes the last. In fact, one might say that when Mr. Williams undertook the task of making a winner out of the Washington Redskins, drama became melodrama. We've always known that Mr. Williams is adept at pulling rabbits out of the hat, but who would have supposed that Otto Graham is the last rabbit? An advocate without peer, even Mr. Williams might quake at the task of persuading Sonny Jurgensen to take that pot off. Mr. Williams, we think of you as a winner, but in bringing victory to Washington, you have surely undertaken what might be characterized as the penultimate challenge. I say penultimate challenge because if you pull that one off, there is an even more heroic task, a veritable Everest, which awaits you. We have here in this town a team called the Boston Red Sox. And we issue the challenge right now. Of course, Mr. Williams might say that one only wants to be a Sabine woman once. It does not offend, I think, our expectations that we learn that Mr. Williams is enthralled by professional football. It is a game that involves these qualities of speed and toughness, of competition and professionalism, of grace and guts and action and learning. All these qualities, which I think will be very much in the forefront, will be very much featured when that inevitable day comes, when Hollywood gives us the Edward Bennett Williams story. Maybe we'll be lucky and we'll even persuade Mr. Ronald Reagan to star. Indeed, if we lawyers ever need a reminder that a life in the law can be led with zest and with style and with excitement and skill, we need look only at the Williams example. It's a scenario that began in Hartford, Connecticut. An early sports note, I understand, from Sports Illustrated is that he was the bat boy at the age of 8 for the Hartford Senators in the Eastern League. Those were the days when Van Lingle Mungo was pitching for the Hartford Senators. For those of you who are aficionados of the game. Mr. Williams took his A.B. degree at Holy Cross. He was first in the class. He was once asked how that came to be. He said simply, I was supposed to be first, so I was first, pregnant with meaning. After a stint in the Army Air Force, he took his law degree at Georgetown, and after a period of practice with one of the Washington firms, he opened his own office in Washington and embarked on the career about which we have all read and learned so much. This career has given him, I think, a very special place at the American bar. I think it's fair to say today that the name Edward Bennett Williams is expresses and is synonymous with one of the great ideals of the American law, the ideal that every person, no matter how much maligned and despised, is entitled to representation and to good representation, the notion that it is the lawyer's duty to represent the unpopular cause. This is an ideal that he has not just preached about. It's an ideal that he has lived. He has lived it with Jimmy Hoffa and with Frank Costello, with Bobby Baker and Adam Powell, with Joe McCarthy and Confidential Magazine. He has done it with a style and a professionalism and a punctiliousness that have earned him the respect and the admiration of the profession and of the public. Edward Bennett Williams is a tremendously famous guy, but I think it is his special quality that living a life surrounded by the famous and the infamous and the notorious, he is still acknowledged to be a lawyer's lawyer, a craftsman, and a gentleman, as well as a public figure. Mr. Williams told Mr. Silver that he will speak to us tonight about the decline of advocacy. I am sure that his statement tonight will be a living refutation of his thesis. It is a very great privilege to welcome to Harvard tonight this man whom I'm sure some people in the Justice Department regard as a nuisance, but whom everybody will acknowledge is at least an attractive nuisance. This vigorous fighter in the law and for the law, this sometimes inconvenient but always essential national asset, Edward Bennett Williams.
Thank you very much, Professor Batter. I want to thank you for the very warm, glowing, generous words of introduction. You really know how to hurt a fellow, though, when you talk about sports. The last time I had an introduction like that was also in Boston. I came up here to make a speech to the annual dinner of the Holy Name Societies of Boston. And I was ushered into a very, very large ballroom at the Sheraton Plaza Hotel. Presiding officer of the evening, by way of introducing me, identified me as the lawyer who had at one time or another represented Frank Costello, Elmer Trigger Burke, and Spex O'Keefe. During the course of the evening, I turned to him and I asked him why he'd singled out these particular former clients as a means of introducing me. He said he was terribly sorry if he'd said anything offensive or inappropriate, but these were the only ones he could find who were members of the Holy Name Society. That same year, Professor Batter, I was invited by the warden down at Atlanta Penitentiary to journey down there and initiate a lecture series as part of the educational program of the inmates. He wrote me a very warm and gracious letter. He said that while his budgetary allowances would not permit him to reimburse me for my expenses, that nonetheless he could guarantee me 100% turnout. When I got there, I found that he was true to his word, because there in this tremendous auditorium were seated about 2,000 men. I saw six or seven familiar faces. As reminders of my past failures, the presiding officer of that evening, like Professor Bator, was a very eloquent and articulate inmate. He waxed on effusively as to how I was held in great esteem and affection by the men down there. And when it seemed that he was caught in a flight of his own rhetoric and would go on interminably, suddenly stopped and put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Oh, well, Mr. Williams, I've talked long enough. Suffice it to say, we fellas down here at Atlanta regard you as one of us." I made what I was told later was a terrible faux pas, because I said to them that night what I say to you tonight. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. And then there was the time, Professor Batter. I was trying a case out in Los Angeles, and I was invited to make a speech to the Ebell Society. I'm told the Ebell Society is the largest women's organization in the whole state of California. They have a practice of inviting people who've written books to come and address their monthly luncheons. And during a recess in the trial, I went over to the Beverly Hills Hotel to speak to them. I was met at the door of the hotel by the chairlady of the occasion, and she handed me a check as an honorarium. I hadn't expected it, and so I contributed it back to the Ebell Society for whatever purposes they would put it. When she was introducing me, she said that I had made this gesture and that she was just thrilled by it because she had just the place for the money to go. It would go into the Ebell Society's fund to get better program speakers next year. I've never figured out whether she was a guileless Mrs. Malaprop or a wily, cunning Madame Defarge type. Because when she made reference to my book, she said, "Unlike Louis Neisser, Mr. Williams has written his book with great humiliation." I don't think she understood Louis's book. I don't think she understood that it was a brilliant expose of a very basic principle, a very basic legal principle, a constitutional principle, that no lawyer need ever discuss a case that he lost. And I've often thought what a really charming thing it would be if some trial lawyer would write a book, and I've often thought of this book, and I'd love to do it, about the cases that he's lost, all the cases he's lost. I even have in my own mind the dust jacket for this book. It's an old Whitney Darrow cartoon of a lawyer standing in front of the jury saying, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if after you have weighed all of the evidence, you find that the balance is tipped in favor of the prosecution and that you must find my client guilty, I ask you to give compassionate consideration to the fact that this will be the 10th straight case I've lost." Then I thought of the first chapter. First chapter I want to call the Minnesota case. I went out to Minnesota in 1951 to try a case for a labor leader. He was charged with violation of the Taft-Hartley Act. We really didn't have a defense, but I gave it a really good try. And at the end of the case, I made what I thought was a good summary. I thought it was very powerful and cogent, and I thought persuasive. I left the courthouse, and I was walking across the street to the Nicolette Hotel when the bailiff tugged me on the sleeve and he said, "The jury's ready, Mr. Williams." So I went back, and the foreman stood up and he announced that the defendant was guilty. Well, I was pretty depressed and rather downcast and a little emotional about it. And the defendant, who was a big, burly type of fella, slapped me on the back. He says, "Don't you feel bad." He says, "Remember what Grantland Rice said. It's not whether you win or lose, but it's how you play the game." And he said it's the same way in trial law. It's not whether you win or you lose. It's how you tried the case. And I just want you to know, I think you tried it real lousy. And in the second chapter, I thought that I would tell a story that Mr. Bernard Goldfein has told in his memoirs about an incident that happened when he and I were doing our best together back in 1958. I received a call one day from some lawyers in Boston asking me to undertake the defense of Mr. Goldfein's income tax case. And I asked them to send the files down. They sent them down, and the files weren't very helpful. The charge was that he had evaded taxes in 53, 54, 55, 56, and 57, and the files indicated he hadn't filed a return in those years. Now, he had a lot of lawyers. There's one that will always stand out in my mind. His name was Ralph Slobodkin. Ralph did a myriad of things. He drove the car, and he got coffee in the morning, and he got cigarettes, and he handled small claims for the mills. He was ubiquitous, and I'm sure extremely useful. On the appointed day for my meeting with Mr. Goldfein, I came up to Danbury, Connecticut, where he was serving 90 days for contempt of court. And I had an associate of mine with me, and we were ushered into the warden's office. He let us use his office for our conference. And after exchanging the social amenities, I said, "Mr. Goldfein, I've looked over your file. I'm sorry to tell you that you just don't have any defense." So he looked at me with steely blue eyes, and he greeted this observation with stony silence. When I left the room a few minutes later, he turned to my associate, and he said to me, "Who does that young mumser think he is, telling me I have no defense? If I had a defense, I'd have Ralph Slobodkin try to get it." I found that story to be very useful in my life in pro football, because when, after 2 weeks, Otto Graham came to me and he said, "We don't have any running backs. We don't have any defensive secondary." I said, "If we had running backs and defensive secondary, we'd still have the old coach." But as proof of my meteoric rise and the fact that I no longer wear a black hat and now wear a white hat, when the reporter from the Crimson came around to interview me about 15 minutes before I came on this platform, who do you think he turned out to be? The sports editor. It's been said so often that it's, I guess, becoming hackneyed and cliched to repeat that trial lawyers are a vanishing breed. Every justice of the Supreme Court, now sitting, has made this observation publicly, either in writing or orally. Now, if it be true that trial lawyers are a vanishing breed, then it must be added and underscored that great trial lawyers in the criminal field are well nigh extinct. I don't know how often I have heard it said this very year by the top partners in New York, Washington, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago firms. The top partners in the biggest firms. Our firm doesn't try criminal cases. Our firm doesn't handle criminal matters. Translated brashly, they are saying, we don't concern ourselves with problems of individual freedom or human liberty. We concern ourselves only with money matters. The last time I was at Harvard Law School was in the summer of 1961 when Professor Livingston Hall ran a seminar on careers in the administration of criminal justice. And I heard one of your professors say, to my great surprise, perhaps it shouldn't have been, that he had polled the first-year law students after they had completed their course in criminal law, and he had found that out of 502 students polled, only 7 were very favorably disposed toward careers in the defense of individual liberty. One of the great polling institutes in this country last year conducted a survey among the high school students in the Midwest. They took a pattern from a poll that had been conducted by Northwestern University, and they listed for the high school students, seniors all, the 14 cardinal principles of the American Bill of Rights, seriatim. And they asked the students to indicate whether they believed in the individual principle or not. Half of them indicated they did not believe that Americans, regardless of their beliefs or convictions, had the right to peaceable assembly. Half of them didn't believe in the privilege against self-incrimination or the principle of double jeopardy or the right of every accused, regardless of what the accusation might be, to confront his accuser and subject him to cross-examination. But they all believed, 100% strong, in the American Bill of Rights. Showing, of course, that they didn't know what the American Bill of Rights is. At the University of Pittsburgh Law School, the dean conducted a survey. And he asked the students whether they would defend a man accused of the Smith Act, advocating the violent overthrow of the government. First, he asked them whether they believed that such a man had the right to counsel. 90% said yes. 10% said no. Only 50% said, however, that if they had the experience and qualifications so to do, that they would lend their talents in such a case. And only 35% of them believed that their preceptors at the Pennsylvania Bar would undertake such a case if qualified. And 90% of them thought that there would be some stigma, some form of ostracism that would inure to them if they undertook the defense of an accused in a case of that kind. All of these things caused the Chief Justice of the United States to observe on one occasion that he doubted if the American Bill of Rights would pass the Congress if offered as a new piece of legislation. I think he understated the case. I don't think it would get out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now it would take an analysis far more profound than any that I can essay here to find why the fires that once blazed in the minds and the hearts of young men everywhere in this country, of young law students, especially, for human freedom and individual liberty and the essential dignity of man, have been so carefully banked. But one thing is sure. Those fires, more than ever in our history, need a new incandescence, because their gradual extinction has created a horrendous vacuum, the American bar. There is a famine of talent, trial talent, in the criminal field. Only the dregs of the bar for the past quarter of a century have been attracted to the defense of human liberty. 33 years ago this very week, the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes, jointly decried the archaic state into which criminal jurisprudence had fallen in this country, and they called upon the organized bar to do something. For 30 years, the bar slumbered on. The cadaver had a little muscle twitch for a year or two while Robert Kennedy was Attorney General. There were some beginnings, but nothing has come of those beginnings. Now, I've asked questions among law students all over this country for years. Why are you not interested? Why do you have no interest in becoming an advocate, in standing at the bar of justice with a man whose liberty society is trying to take away? And I've received three answers. It's unremunerative. 70% of the prospective clients can't afford to pay. It's undignified because of the invidious concept of guilt by clients. And it's unworthy of our talent. There's no stimulation in the law schools in this direction. We're not taught anything about advocacy. We're not stimulated with respect to matters dealing with individual freedom. And if you look over the curriculum, you have to come to that same conclusion, because the curricula of the great law schools are really steeped in real property and personal property and trusts and taxation and corporations and partnership and business associations and contracts and torts and damages. But there's not very much in there about human freedom or individual liberty. Now, I say the time has come to make a dramatic and bold new try. Time has come for us to make a two-cushion shot, designed to stem the decline in the caliber of advocacy and also to reach out toward the solution of the most important problem in the administration of justice in this country today, the defense of the indigent. The time has come to put into the law school curricula across the country real courses in advocacy, using the lecture method, using clinical demonstrations and exercises designed to teach principles, tactics, techniques, and stratagems. Techniques and stratagems of the courtroom. A course designed after the great course that Lloyd Paul Stryker gave in the 50s at Yale in the art of advocacy. And then I suggest that in third year there should be a period of externship, a period where the student works with the public defender or the legal aid society or the organized bar, doing investigative work on the facts and research on the law and sitting through the trial of the case with a lawyer assigned to it so that he can see the machinery of justice in operation. And finally, I think we should take a page from medical education and have a period of internship. Period where the student, after he takes his law degree, actually works in the courtroom for a year or even 2 years looking toward a doctorate, trying cases, literally trying cases for the indigent in the community where his law school is located. And that way we can once again begin to develop advocates and we can reach out toward the solution of the problem that beleaguers us, defending the indigent. In this way, you can come to grips with the machinery of justice and you can begin to feel and see it. And come down from the ethereal abstractions of the ivory tower and out of the monastic cells of the law review and see the machinery of justice, imperfect as it is, work. Because the fact is, today, law student graduates can't find the courthouse with a compass. It's time we did something about it. Then we've got to get the message across that the courtroom is the institution most essential to the preservation of human dignity. Without it, we would descend to the barbarous battleground where might makes right, where the mace prevails over honor, where the male fist crushes the truth. It's the courtroom where the work of the barons at Runnymede and the legacy of the founding fathers at Philadelphia become the guardians of the sublime rights with which man came into this world and with which he must leave it. I think that there can be nothing so exhilarating, so rewarding, so satisfying, so challenging as a hard-won triumph for the right in a court of justice. Terence Rattigan, in his
Wonderful play. The Winslow boy caught the spirit. He caught the spirit of the trial bar. The lawyer who had pushed and shoved, dragged and tugged a young lad through a morass of bureaucratic indifference, over the barricades of parliamentary pressure, beyond the numbing influences of governmental presumptions and administrative delays, to emerge with the young lad's honor vindicated and his honesty upheld, is a man who, in one of the great moments of his life, has explored the pinnacle of the human spirit and has known the transcendent joy of real human achievement. Such an experience, if enjoyed only once in a lifetime, is no mean accomplishment. Then I say, we must get rid, once and for all, bury the insidious concept of guilt by climate, which turns the young lawyer away from the defense of liberty. It's been said many times that you can take all human trouble and divide it into three categories. The trouble that we have with our bodies, and we have the medical profession to care for it. Spiritual troubles entrusted to the clergy. And the troubles that man has with his fellow man and with society as a whole, which are entrusted to the trial lawyer. Those are the three professions that deal with human trouble. And I say to you that money and power and glory may be the prime motivators of men, but there is no motivation so great as the alleviation of human pain. And if you can't be a clergyman and you can't stand the biology laboratory, then you can find this life at the trial bar. No doctor worthy of the name would turn away a patient because his disease was loathsome or incurable. And no clergyman worthy of the name would turn away a penitent because his sins were too heinous. The same principle works with inexorable efficacy for the trial bar. The only difference is that whereas the doctor and the clergyman work in the privacy of their offices and their rectories, we work in the public arena. These are just basic rules of reason and decency. And every good system of justice incorporates basic rules of reason and decency within itself. And so it was in 1791, when the founding fathers wrote the American Bill of Rights. They wrote into it the Sixth Amendment. They provided that every accused should have the right to counsel, no matter how unorthodox his views or his conduct, no matter how socially or politically obnoxious, no matter how high the evidence appears to be marshaled against him, no matter how great the obloquy that inures to his name, he has the right to counsel. Rights and duties are correlative ideas. No one can have a right unless there be a corresponding duty on the rest of society to respect it. The right to counsel would be a very barren right indeed unless there were a corresponding obligation on the members of our profession to provide that counsel when it is sought within the limits of decency and integrity. To that end, the American Bill of Rights is a bill of obligations. But we fail to get this message across, either within the profession or outside the profession. We are suffering from historical myopia. History will show us, if we will but look, that the great constitutional fights have been fought and the great constitutional principles have been forged in cases involving not very nice people. The scorned and the degraded and the ostracized and the friendless, the downtrodden, the contemptible, the ridiculous, and the poor. When big government infringes on the area of human liberty or individual freedom, it begins with the friendless, the scorned, the degraded, and the ostracized. It doesn't begin with the orthodox, the conformist, the affluent, or the strong. Why? Because they can rally public support. The history of American civil liberties has been written in the criminal courtrooms across this land from the birth of this nation. I tried to document this theory in a book that I wrote, which I recounted the story of some of the most celebrated cases for the preceding decade, to show that in each one of those cases there was a vital principle at stake, a principle important to every one of us, a principle that had to be preserved regardless of the identity of the immediate beneficiary of the principle. John Donne wrote some poignant lines in the 17th century, lines which have application to the problems of civil liberties in the 1960s. He said, "No man is an island unto himself. Never send to sea for whom the bell tolls, because it tolls for thee." In the true sense of the term, history is making advocates of all of us. In the great ideological conflict that is engulfing the world today, we're all willy-nilly advocates for our system, as against the Soviet system. And nothing dramatizes the decline in advocacy so much as the fact that in the continuing debate with the Soviets, we are constantly picking the wrong issues, the wrong forums, and the wrong times. We debate economic productivity, standard of living, military strength, scientific advance, when we should be meeting them on the jugular issue. The issue on which we must prevail, the difference between government by consent and government by compulsion. Because ours is a government of laws and rules and principles, not of men. In our system, those who are in authority are nonetheless under the law. In theirs, those who are in authority are the law. Our law is a rational restraint upon the unfettered exercise of the men whom we've elected to power, the unfettered exercise of power by these men. And their law is merely the projection of the will of the little band of men who've seized the reins of government. I've often thought and said, the whole difference is wonderfully illustrated in the fact that in Moscow,
In Red Square, they keep on display under glass for all to see the corpse of Lenin. Whereas in Washington at the National Archives, we have on display under glass for all to see the American Constitution with its Bill of Rights. There are dark and difficult days ahead. We're coursing most of our national resources and energies and most of our young manpower into a massive effort to contain the spread of global communism, all to the end that the freedom, the liberty, and the dignity of man as we have known it shall be preserved. It would be a tragic paradox if in the name of that effort we should allow any of these freedoms to be surrendered. For we should have done to ourselves from within what we fear most from without. It's against this surrender that the bar must set itself in the ensuing years. Our freedom in this country is the end product of a myriad of episodes. Though it was born on a battlefield, it's had its growth and its evolution in our courtrooms. A gradual growth of habits and attitudes. No one event has marked its victory. No one event, its decline. Its vigor or its weakness is marked by a pattern of events so small as to be well nigh invisible in the total mosaic of American democracy. The great responsibility of the bar as we move toward the close of this century is to remain intellectually sensitive to those episodes and emotionally concerned about them, regardless of the identity of the individuals involved, and to translate that sensitivity and that concern into eloquence and action through advocates worthy of the glorious traditions of the past.
I'm a local attorney. Mr. Williams, what would your attitude be with respect to defending a person who refused to submit to the draft, a draft card burner or a non-draft card burner? If you were called upon to defend such a person.
Well, I don't really think that it's the function of the advocate to delineate between the various charges that can be brought against an accused. The Constitution, as I read it, doesn't say that everyone accused of a crime except draft card burning is entitled to counsel, or everyone accused of a crime except draft evasion is entitled to a defense. It says every accused is entitled to a defense, and I think that if that is to have meaning, then there must be a right to counsel, and then there must be a duty on the part of counsel when he's called upon to provide assistance to give it, if he can do it. Now, of course, there comes a time when you may have so many demands on your time that you can't take all the cases that are sent to you, but I don't have any problem at all with respect to the nature of the accusation that's brought against the defendant. I don't think that's our function as advocates to evaluate what the seriousness of the offense is, or whether there are patriotic overtones to the accusation or not. I have no problem at all. I wouldn't hesitate, of course, for a moment to represent someone accused of those crimes. And I don't think any other advocate should. For reasons that some obloquy might attach to him if he did it, I think the canons of ethics require trial lawyers to prescind entirely from whatever the consequences may be to them personally from the defense of the cause that they undertake. The answer directly to your question is yes, I would defend such a case. I would have no hesitation to defend such a case.
My name is Bill Vickery, first-year law student. I would like to ask you whether you think the Smith and the remaining provisions of the McCarran Acts, which some consider to be infringements on our liberty, are unjustified with respect to a due concern for order in this country.
Well, I haven't read the opinions that came out of the Supreme Court for a long time, but I remember very clearly being quite impressed with the logic of the opinions that came down on the Smith Act at the time that they did come down, and I agreed wholeheartedly with them then, and have had no reason to change my views with respect to them. I happen to believe that we are blessed in this country with a very, very great Supreme Court. I think it is one of the greatest courts in our history as a nation. I think we have a great Chief Justice, and I find myself thrilled week after week as I strike the Liberty Bell in the area of civil liberties. I know that there is... I know that there are others that have different views on this subject, but I find myself generally in accord with the views of the majority of the court as it is now constituted.
My name is Carl Krasick. I wondered what your opinion was on the criticisms of the Warren Commission reports that have come out recently.
Well, I haven't read the criticisms. I have read the reviews of Mark Lane's book. I have not read the book. I have read large sections of the Warren Commission report. I thought it was a first-rate job that the Warren Commission did. I really think that they arrived at the right conclusion by the right means. I think they did a very, very lawyer-like job in weighing all the evidence and coming to conclusions only after evaluating the evidence in the most careful way. And I would find it most difficult to believe that the criticisms that have been heaped upon them in this new flux of books that have come out are really justified.
My name is Whitney Duran. I want to ask you a question which is also within the realm of expertise of Professor Bator as reporter for the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment. What is your opinion as to the advisability of a stop and frisk statute such as adopted in New York?
I think it's very bad. I think it's... I think it's violative of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. I believe that there must be a reasonable basis for a search of that kind, and I think that there must exist probable cause for stopping a man, putting him under arrest, inhibiting him from complete mobility, and then searching him. And I think anything that seeks to shortcut the basic constitutional safeguards of the Fourth Amendment won't stand the test of constitutionality. I thought your questions were going to be a lot tougher because the last time I was here, I got into a lot of trouble. It wasn't the last time, it was the first time I was here. I just finished the Hoffa case in 1957. And I came up here to speak at the Harvard Law Forum And I had a thing called Asian flu. I had a high fever. So I slept over in the Carlton Hotel all afternoon, the Ritz-Carlton. I came over here, and I felt fine when I started, but after about 45 minutes, my shirt got wet, and I could feel my temperature going up, and I finished my remarks, and I started to answer the questions. And some fellow way in the back of the room put his hand up, and he said, Mr. Williams, he says, are you proud of the fact that you had Joe Lewis come in the courtroom in the Hoffa case? Well, I had answered that question many times. I'd written a chapter in a book about it, and it explained exactly what had happened. And it took about 8 or 10 minutes to explain it, and I didn't feel like as though I could go for 8 or 10 minutes. So I made a flip remark, which I have regretted ever since. I said, no, I'm not proud of it. I tried to get Sugar Ray Robinson, and he was busy. Everybody laughed. It got printed, and I have been trying to answer ever since that I was joking, and it didn't happen that way. And so when I went to New York to try the Adam Clayton Powell case, I received a special delivery letter the first day I was there, and the letter read, Dear Mr. Williams, I understand you have the habit of using old broken-down ex-heavyweight champions in the defense of your cases. I want you to know I'm available, Gene Tunney. Well, I have had to explain for 10 years that I made a remark which was taken as a concession of the fact that I had had Joe Lewis come into the courtroom, which I hadn't, and I made it facetiously at the Harvard Law Forum, and I've never been able to live it down, all of which proves what Adlai Stevenson found out. You can't be a wisecracker and get to be president.
Listening to recorded highlights of the Harvard Law School Forum. Tonight's featured speaker was attorney Edward Bennett Williams. The moderator was Professor Paul M. Batter. The Harvard Law School Forum is another Voice of the City feature of WHDH News and Public Affairs.